So with that, needless to say, it's wonderful to be home in Tennessee. And I'm here at Top of the World Farm with Franklin. We've just had a typical great dinner at the Sanders household. And so, Franklin, is the technology working, and are you with us?
It actually is, but it almost defeated me. Again, I couldn't just pick up the phone on the phone system and be on your line. I had to call in. So we both called into Idaho or Monaco or wherever it is. But I'm here and ready to go. Listen, I didn't realize that you knew about John Taylor Gatto. You didn't
tell
me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I interviewed him about 7 years ago, I think. But his Underground History of American Education is one of the most informative books I've ever read, and formative, too, since once you read it and understand how American public education, who formed American education and who put the money behind making it what it is, you don't understand that unless you read Gatto's book. It's a fabulous piece of work. The Underground History of American Education.
It's one of the things I love about Gatto is he's a very hardworking man, but he's also a very smart man. And so he can unpack, you know, he's gone back and figured it all out, how it got to be this bad. And it's almost by understanding how it got to be this bad that you really comprehend how bad it is. And it's through that that you understand the opportunity. And we're going to talk about it later because the documentary this week is on a school that I think has shown, you know, how good it can be. You know, it's remarkable. I will also say he's given – somebody gave me a recording of one of his speeches, and his speeches and interviews are fantastic. And I remember listening to one as I drove back for Tennessee for – I had a couple of his – tapes and speeches, and you know, within a couple of hours, I pretty much had the 411 and the entire American educational system because he can lay it out that clearly. Yeah, very clear.
Right. And you know, the final thing about him is that he's so cheerful with it all. He's not, you know, he's not. There's nothing about him depressing. You know, he's got some rough facts to face, but he faces them and he's still cheerful. It's really, really a great, great man. Very great man.
He taught all his kids how to beat the system. Okay, so there's been an awful lot since we talked to you last, Franklin. So why don't you just do, let's start with a bring down of the gold and silver market since we talked on the last precious metals market report.
Well, let's start with the context first. The context is that the central banks of the world, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the Fed, have announced that they are going to inflate forever. There is no limit on the inflation. It's going to be QE to infinity. And that, of course, is not good news for the economy, but it certainly is the best news that silver and gold could get. So against that backdrop, of course, they're trying to get their own economies going, and they very stupidly believe still, or claim to believe, that inflation will help that. And it's interesting to look at the performance of the stock market, which does not show that their inflation is going to help. It shows that the idea that they're going to inflate stimulates the market for a week or two, and then it flakes. It just dies off. It has no more effect. And it's really difficult to avoid that comparison with a heroin addict, you know, they have to take bigger and bigger doses to get the same effect. Looking at the market, the dollar, of course, was driven down, and I think certainly assuming that the Fed works with the other central banks, which we know that they do, that was part of a plan to try and help bail the Europeans out of their tight spot. They drove the dollar down, and if you have that chart that I sent in front of you, you can see it.
Yeah,
it's done
just, let me just tell everybody if you check out the charts in the webinar software, we're going to be walking through some charts. So I have the dollar chart up, Franklin.
And it what happened was the dollar built out into an even-sided triangle, sort of, and then it fell down out of that triangle, but that proved to be a false breakdown. It didn't follow through and go down farther. It came back up. Now, whether this is just a small reaction or not is not clear, but if it gets through, it's been trying to go up, and if it gets through, that would be the biggest surprise going. Because everybody knows, of course, since the QE3 announcement that the dollar is going to evaporate. Well, you know, when everybody knows something in markets, it means they've already placed their bets, and probably that's not what's going to happen. So I think a surprise rally in the dollar to about 81 or so, maybe even a little higher than that, would just terrify stock investors, and it would not comfort gold and silver investors either, so it would set a headwind up against them. I don't think that's going to last very long, that rally, but we might see that sort of ruling things for the next 4 or 5 weeks. If the dollar closes below 70, 79 points on the dollar index, then I'm wrong. That's not going to happen. That would indicate, no, the dollar is going to go further down. But if you look at the dollar versus the euro, the euro is not—it's nothing to brag about. It looks very sick too. So, the dollar is what's hanging over the market right now, and we might get a little surprise rally. And this is only a passing thing. If you look at the gold-silver ratio chart, and I think I sent you that one too.
Yeah, that's something.
You notice the ratio went up to 59-1, at least on the chart I've got. And then it started coming down, and when it came down very, very fast in August. And when it did, it left two gaps behind. That's typical technical behavior of a market that's in a big hurry, but there's a market proverb that gaps are always filled. So, in other words, you can expect it to trade back up into those gaps at some time in the future. Right now, it's turned around, and it's trying to react or correct back up to, say, 54 or so. And, of course, a rising ratio means that gold and silver normally are falling. And so that's another sign that gold and silver are not going to run away to the upside anytime soon. Not to mention the political pressure of having this election hanging in front of us, and people actually believe it's going to make a difference whether Peter Pan or Tinkerbell is elected. I don't think it'll make any difference because they both believe or profess to believe the same stupid Keynesian theories that say that inflation is good for the economy, whereas inflation and government spending kill the economy. So you'll get, as you say, different beneficiaries and a different focus, but it will be the same mess whichever one of them gets elected. So I think that you've got that hanging over the gold and silver markets as well. If you look at gold and silver both, if you look at those charts, you see very plainly in the gold chart that gold was on a fast track upward and hit resistance a little below 1800 and just stopped cold and backed off back to about 1740. Made another try to break through that ceiling, got almost to $1,800 an ounce, and then backed off again. Well, what you've got, what is formed is called a broadening top. And it could be a consolidation. It could just fool me and, you know, just trade sideways between 1740 and 1800 and then move right on up through 1800. But it looks like to me it's a broadening top, and it's closed below the 20-day moving average, which is the first tripwire of lower prices. So I think you're going to get a correction maybe to 1700 or maybe as low as 1660, 1650. And that's going to come fairly soon. Ought to come fairly soon. But, you know, the end of the year, December is almost always an up month for gold and silver. And so between now and December, now in the end of November, there's going to be some sort of interim bottom in silver and gold, and then they'll head on up sometime before the 1st of December into the end of the year. Silver chart looks just about like the gold chart. The parameters, the boundaries are different, of course. It's about 3450. It would have to exceed 3450 to say that it was, to judge that it was continuing its rally, and then it would have to go below I have to go below about 3350 to say that it was going further down. I think that it will. I think we're going to get a correction here because that was a long, powerful rally that came up out of August. And so it's normal to expect a correction here. But it's still a strong bull market.
You were expecting a correction before last month, and it didn't happen. And so you were starting to think maybe it might not. But I think the charts, what you're saying, the charts really say it is.
Yeah, the chart pattern is not one. It could be a continuation pattern, you know, where it just kind of clogs sideways. But I don't think so. I think given that previous rise, that we're going to get a greater correction before it takes off. But you know, we've started something really huge.
Right.
The first and minimal target for this move is $2,000, and then past that, probably $2,300 by the middle of next year, and on the way to, maybe $4,500 on this leg. Sounds crazy, I know, and I just have to preface by saying I know it sounds crazy, but that's the way the numbers look.
You know, I was very interested in having a variety of people in my network take gains. You know, they've been in for a very long time, and so take gains starting at 1800 and start to shift. But when the QE3 was announced, it was much more aggressive than I expected. And both then and since, it looks to me like, the long term on precious metals now looks much more significant over a 2 to 3 year period. So it gave me pause to reconsider. And I want to talk a little bit in a minute about, you know, what Bernanke really did and what's really going on. There was one estimate, and I hate to quote Goldman Sachs, but one estimate, you know, for those who don't know, what Bernanke said was he was going to buy $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities from the financial institutions until he felt that unemployment was low again. Now, the interesting thing is that his action has done a great deal to create unemployment. So this is a little bit like, he's saying that he's going to keep inflating until employment is solved, when in fact the very thing he's doing is creating unemployment. So that's the basis of saying this can go to infinity. But one of the estimates, because what I believe he's really doing is he's clearing the real estate market. He's saying, okay, I now commit to all you large financial institutions that I will buy up the rest of the fraudulent paper. So I used to have a deputy at FHA when I worked there who said that FHA was where mortgages go to die. You know, so everybody would refinance the crap into FHA and then it would die there.
Right.
In fact, I remember we once had a nursing home that I found that we had underwritten 100% loan-to-value mortgage at $8 million. And by the time I found it, our property disposition operation, in addition to the $8 million, had spent another $12 million maintaining the property. And it was kind of the gift that keeps on giving. But but I think what Bernanke has basically done is turned around to the financial institutions and said, I commit to take all of this fraudulent paper off your balance sheet at par. So, you know, if you've got it on your books for $100, I'm going to take it off at $100, even if it's worth 10 cents. And Goldman Sachs came out with a projecting that it would take until 2015, and he would spend on QE3, he would buy $2 trillion of paper. Pretty stunning.
Well, now, it is. That's what I'm saying. There's no limit. That's the thing. There's no limit. And this is what I've said before, I think, in our conversations here, that the tactic that normally comes at the end of these bubbles is to create a garbage can mechanism to take all the bad paper and put it over in there and somehow or the other shift it off onto the taxpayer's back. Well, Bernanke is saying the Fed is the garbage can. And I agree with you 100%. That's what he's doing. He's saying, I'm going to clean up the banks balance sheets by becoming the garbage can for the banks.
I think he's also saying something else, and that is we cannot trust the civil service to shred these criminal liabilities. It's too dangerous.
Oh,
so we, a private bank, have to do it. In other words, when you take in that $2 trillion of paper, you're taking in $2 trillion of criminal liabilities. Right?
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So I don't think they want government, I don't think they want to do an RTC or they want FHA to buy them because they can't afford, you know, the civil service will leak. And the civil service will want bonuses when they see who's making this much money on this kind of stuff. So I think part of what he's saying is not only is the Fed the garbage can, but it's a toxic waste dump because, you know, it's financial nuclear waste. You can't trust government to do it, which is pretty extraordinary. And one of the questions, I think, in terms of the money supply, Franklin, is, if you're pulling in $40 billion a month and you're pulling in the pyramid of derivatives and leverage on top of that, in fact, you know, that can be deflationary to the money supply because you've got this pyramid of paper that is really not circulating on Main Street. It's sort of on the side. They've kept it in its own separate economy, and now they're pulling in a tremendous amount. And so, on one hand, it's inflating of the money supply, but on the other hand, if you're pulling in all that leverage and everybody's able to close out those derivative books, it can be, in its own sense, deflating.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like the bailout. They gave out trillions of dollars, but the banks didn't lend it. They just lent it back to the government, who wrote more subsidy checks to everybody in America.
Right. I looked at it a different way. I looked at it that Bernanke is cleaning up the bank's balance sheets so they can – he's giving them 100 cents for an asset that's worth 20 cents, and that's going to hugely boost the amount of cash and the amount of reserves that they have. And
yes,
they're going to just recycle that into government paper, and they're going to have a nice, neat profit for doing nothing, basically.
Right.
They're going to get rid of their bad paper and get good paper in exchange. So,
right, and they're going to lend more money to the government, who's got nobody to buy their debt.
Well, that's scary too. I mean, you'd hope that they would lend more to private individuals as well, or to businesses. But in any event, this is no way to run an economy. The adults have left the building and left the juveniles in charge, or left the criminals.
Right. I think it's a way to control the economy. I don't think it's a way to run the economy.
Right.
But, basically they're ping-ponging back and forth the cash between the banks and the government debt. And then they're running the entire government economy through the federal budget. And that's why I think the question of the fiscal cliff and what's going to happen is so important. So, if we come into the fiscal cliff with the Fed having basically written a hedge to the entire financial community that they're going to pull in all the real estate debt and clear that market, and you come into the fiscal cliff with that in mind, because I don't think you could engineer the fiscal cliff with that hanging over the markets, it's going to be very interesting. I wanted to mention one other thing. I talked a lot last week about the fact that we've seen the stock market trade up and down with the QE. So QE1 happens, the market trades up. QE2 happens, the market trades up. You know, then it starts to go down, we get the next QE. And one of the questions we have is the money going into the stock market, or is it instead being used to pump corporate earnings? Because if you look at corporate earnings, they're doing the same pattern. They're going up. And one of the challenges in the equity markets, because the equity markets, in my opinion, are overvalued right now, you've had corporate earnings going up tremendously, and corporate earnings are in for a correction. And this week and next, we're coming into the next 2 weeks, we're coming into the season of corporate earnings announcements. and the expectation is that they'll be down. So it's hard to imagine how this QE is going to give more bounce to corporate earnings, particularly because so much of it comes through the federal budget. And
so much of corporate earnings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's funny. You know, many people look at a stock market portfolio and they see private companies. I see government contractors and companies which are highly dependent on government purchases or governments rigging markets for them in a whole variety of different ways. And a lot of companies that people think are private companies are really not there. They're very much, you know, government contractors.
Right.
Well, before we go to the fiscal cliff, is there anything you wanted else you wanted to touch on the market? I've got the silver chart up. And?
Well, you know, I guess I'm still thinking about a brush I had with a customer today, and the customer, it made me think about timing, you know, and we've talked about this a lot, that the best thing to do is to go in and just buy. If a market's trending up, the best thing for you to do is buy, because even your timing mistakes will be bailed out. And I had this customer call and ask me about swapping or about selling some silver and gold that he had bought in 2008. And I looked at it, and the gold was up 208%, the silver was up 223%. And he had bought in August of 2008. And that, after that, if you remember, gold and silver fell off the cliff. He had bought at 805, silver, gold fell to 705. He had bought at 1416 silver, and it fell to 880. So it looked like there, within about 2 months, that the end of the world had come for him, and he had made a horrible mistake. But he sat tight, and now, you know, it's worth nearly 2.25 times what he paid for it. So
right.
It's just the magic of an up, you know, primary trend. It keeps going up, and you just have to, you have to ride that trend. That's the main thing. You have to keep from being anxious and worrying about whether or not this thing is really going to go up. You know, if you identify the primary trend and you ride that, then you're going to be all right.
I will say this. I kind of feel if you don't have a core position, it's important to get in and get a core position. But when we're this far above, when the price is this far above the moving averages,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't think it hurts to kind of wait until you get back closer to the moving averages.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Yeah, not on the core position, but on, because you don't have to buy all at once. Okay, so let's turn to the fiscal cliff. And actually,
mm-hmm.
before we go to the fiscal cliff, I just want to ask you, you know, because more rumors out of Russia today about the possibility of a strike on Iran, which I think is remote before the election, but, you know, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you know, we've seen a pattern in recent years of whenever war kicks up, the price, the tangible prices come down. So I think
mm-hmm.
the question is, if we do get more war in the Middle East, what's it going to do to gold and silver?
You know, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, because there are two different things that are tugging at each other. One is that gold and silver are seen as crisis hedges, and so they have a tendency to jump when there's some kind of crisis like that. That, of course, is a passing phenomenon. And if you'll remember, when Bush arranged the war against Iraq, the gold rose into that crisis, and then once they invaded Iraq, it dropped. So I don't think you can say altogether that war is good, at least not in the first few months, for gold. I mean, that it necessarily pushes up gold.
Right. Well, you know, my expectation is if we do get an attack on Iran, I think so long as it's successful, it'll be strong for the dollar. And if that happens, I think it'll hit most tangible prices really hard. So that's one thing. You know, if you are in a position where you're going to need to be selling, that's one thing to keep in mind. But I don't think it's likely before the election. Although, you know, who knows? This environment is sufficiently nuts that I hate to predict anything in the short run.
I couldn't imagine Obama agreeing to that now because of the turmoil that it would create. But I also just, maybe it just, I'm too incredulous, but I can't imagine them invading or, you know, bombing Iran. I mean, it would be an act of criminal stupidity.
Funny. Apparently, the Daily Post quoted Henry Kissinger in September as saying, "In 10 years, the state of Israel would not exist." And I said to myself, and apparently he hadn't retracted it. And I said, "Oh dear, nerves are really fraying." Well, we have a question from San Diego. Do you see anything on the horizon that could cause the price of gold to drop substantially?
No, I don't. Not war, not change of administrations, none of that stuff. Because
well, it depends on what you mean is by substantially. I mean, I think you think it could correct down as far as 1600. And if we got a war, maybe 1650.
I don't think even that would take it down below 1600. No.
Okay.
I just don't, because the trend is we're just coming out of, you know. Put everything else in the world out of your mind and just look at the chart. And if you do that, and you do that with the assumption, well, everything that everybody who's in the market knows is in that chart, then there's nothing I can see in that chart that does not say we're going way higher and we're going to do it soon. We've already started. And when I say way higher, I mean way, way higher. Remember that the first peak that we hit at around $1,000 in 2008, that was just the first leg up. And we're not anything like through the second leg up. We had this big correction, and now it's getting ready to move on farther up. So I guess that's the way I look at it. I look at it as everything I can see is in that chart. What I don't see in that chart is a fundamental change that would change the inflationary policies and the inflationary financing and the corrupt financing that we now have. Those charts, the silver and gold charts, say to me there's no cure in sight. There's not even a hint of a cure in sight.
Well, actually, I would say that Mr. Global would say that the a steadily rising gold and silver price will cure the situation quite nicely in their favor.
Well, how do you
mean
that?
Not a radical debasement, but it's a slow burn debasement. Well, I think once you've used fiat currency to steal everything, you want to go back to sound money, because sound money is going to help you keep what you've stolen.
Sure.
So, you know, that's Murphy and I always squabbled about that. I kept saying, you know, what do you mean you're going to defeat J.P. Morgan Chase? You know, when gold flies up, you know, the people who control it are going to get exactly what they want. Another question, will QE3 affect liquidity in any great way here in the U.S., and will the efforts to inflate Europe, Japan, and China increase liquidity here? Whose liquidity affects metal prices the most?
I assume that means who's liquidity in which country. And of course, you know, the dollar is very much the world currency. So I would have to say that dollar liquidity affects it more than anything else. But I think that question is kind of upside down, because the gold is a, I think of gold as a competing currency to all those other currencies. And so liquidity, which means funds that people have, is going to flow to its safest and most lucrative location. And if the market thinks that's gold, they'll take money out of whatever currency they're in. They'll swap that currency for gold.
Right. I think the biggest challenge that the Fed has and the central banks have is you have a very, very huge stock market, and you have a bond market that's twice as big as that, and you have a tiny precious metals market. And the question is, how do you keep all the money in the bond market when you're giving people no yield, And it's that bond market that's financing the government, and the government is basically controlling the economy by running everything through the federal balance sheet. So how do you keep that huge pyramid of money in the bond market piled with derivatives on top? How do you keep it there, and how do you keep it from moving too fast into something else? And I think one of the advantages of clearing the real estate is it gives you a way to bring some of that money in. If it all just filed into the precious metals market, you would have, you know, you could literally have the whole thing unravel. So you can't afford for precious metals to go up too fast. And that's why I always say if it goes up too fast at once, you know, you run the risk of war, because what it means is they're losing control of the slow burn. And that is not going to be to their advantage.
So you mean that would drive them to the wall so that they would have to have a war? They'd have to have war.
Yeah, they'd have to do something extreme. The one thing I do want to bring across, and I'm being very repetitive about this, but liquidity, when the Fed buys in this money, so when the Fed buys $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities in from the big financial institutions, that money is not moving out as liquidity into the general economy. So from everything I see, Franklin, when you drive through Tennessee and you drive through the towns in Tennessee, the money supply in small towns is shrinking, and it continues to shrink. The liquidity is not, you know, you've got a town, everybody's keeping their deposits and dollar deposits, the purchasing power is shrinking, and their liquidity is shrinking. If these towns could do their own currencies, you would see a flurry of activity because there's just not enough currency for all the activity that wants to happen. And so, you know, on mainstream, in terms of money supply, you're watching a deflation happen. Even though the money supply is expanding dramatically, totally, but the Fed has found, you know, has been able to literally keep a pumping system going whereby that money never goes into general circulation.
It never reaches Main Street.
Except in the food prices. I mean, in the prices of essentials, yes, it reaches Main Street in terms of rising expenses, but in terms of rising liquidity, not at all. The liquidity has been very, very much constrained. And I think it's important to understand that because that, you know, if that continues next year, we're talking, when I said that we're going to get a 1-2 punch, you know, Congress is going to punch the middle class with the fiscal changes on both tax increases and spending, and QE3 is going to hit them from the other side by dramatically raising gas and food and other essential prices. And it's really going to be a 1-2 punch that comes all at the same time. Well, let's turn to the fiscal cliff then, because and I'm going to talk a lot about it next week. But well, let's go to the slow burn, because one of the things that happened when I published the article about QE3, you and I started dialoguing about how, what are the mechanisms that have allowed the system to keep the slow burn going. Why are we not yet in hyperinflation? How has the Fed been able to keep interest rates at almost nothing? And one of the things I said was, well, you can offset monetary inflation with labor deflation. And you ended up writing a piece for the Money Changer, which was quite wonderful about our discussion. So maybe if you could say a little bit about it.
Well, I think Your explanation is that by lowering labor costs, lowering demand for labor and lowering labor costs, that they can stave off some of the price inflationary and wage inflationary effects of the inflation. And maybe they can. I don't know. I mean, you know, certainly there has not been, we have not suffered a terrible price inflation, even though the monetary inflation has been huge. And I always, you know, I'm always at pains to distinguish between the monetary, between monetary inflation and what people call inflation, which is just rising prices. That's not at all the same thing.
Well, I think globalization has given the wherewithal to do a lot of this offset between monetary inflation and labor deflation. So by globalizing and outsourcing tremendous amounts of things, we've been able to access much less expensive labor globally and also bring down the price of labor domestically because they're taking, you know, they're having to compete much more. The question is, can you keep that going? And I think a lot of the just ferocious attacks you've seen on the unions around the country is in part to keep that going. So there really is an effort to fundamentally shift the value of labor vis-a-vis, you know, so human capital versus financial capital is, that's ongoing. To me, if you look, so that's been a tremendous benefit from the beginning of the 90s to now in terms of helping prevent that kind of price deflation that you just mentioned. I think the big one going forward over the next 2 to 3 years, to me, is more than labor deflation, it's going to be new technology. And I think if you look at some of the areas where they're pushing to bring on new technology, including digital currencies, that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why, is they think it can be unbelievably useful in helping, you know, keep the slow burn going. Now, if it goes the way it looks, it's going to have a tremendous impact on employment, and there's no discussion that I know of well, what's going to replace the employment model? If people are no longer needed to be workers, exactly how are they going to organize their financial well-being? And everything we've seen people try to do to respond to that and say, okay, well, I'm going to grow my own food. I'm going to manufacture my own stuff. I'm going to, if anything, we're watching government regulation try and prevent all of that. So there's a definite squeeze on trying to, you know, disintermediate out of the system and out of the income model. And so there's, to me, that's going to be a very big question mark that comes right down to this question of labor devaluation and keeping the slow burn going. So they're saying you can't work, but you can't build equity either. Well, what's the plan?
Well, what are you going to do with all these people? When you've got, you know, 40% unemployed and the people become, in the Nazi phrase, nutzlose Fresse, that is, useless eaters, what are you going to do with them? I mean, that's a nightmare. The whole thing is just a nightmare idea. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, 60% of you people are going to have to go die. I mean, I guess you can, but that's so inhumane, it's almost impossible to conceive. But there's no question that globalization must necessarily lower U.S. wage rates, must necessarily. I mean, it has.
Yeah.
You can't. A $30 an hour union worker in Detroit cannot compete with a $2 a day Chinese laborer. I mean, don't tell me about skilled labor. I mean, what he's doing is operating the machine. That's not, you know, it's not like it's not that kind of skill.
Right.
So there's no question that they're doing that, but the you know, then you come to deeper questions, and this is what I came to with you in our conversation. Who is doing this? Why are they doing it? I mean if you're saying, well, they're supporting progress, well, it's mindless. It's not progress to make life impossible for large numbers of people. That's not progress.
Well, it's centralizing control in a way that decreases wealth. Now, one argument...
Well, it decreases the distribution of wealth.
Oh, it decreases total wealth. So you're shrinking the pie, but you're controlling it. So what we're looking at is very significant wealth destruction. And, you know, if you look at wealth on a real basis,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's been shrinking, and part of it is when people are extremely unhappy about their governance system and they don't trust it, then activity shrinks, entrepreneurial activity shrinks. So, well, let's turn to the fiscal cliff, because unfortunately it's only going to get better next year.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go through a couple of key points that I've made before. I'm going to make them again next week. I put up the Accountants Association, Franklin, did sort of a video promoting solutions to the quote-unquote fiscal cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And And one of the things they did is something I've seen happen for several years, affirming that David Walker was the leader. He's the former, it's a former Arthur Andersen partner who was a controller general for many years of the General Accounting Office, which is Congress's auditor. And when he left the GAO, he became head of, Pete Peterson set up a little foundation, and they made a video and have been touring the country promoting solutions to the quote-unquote fiscal cliff. And so basically what I said was that David Walker was being affirmed as the official liar-in-chief. And I want to talk about the big lies on the budget, because it's very important to understand that this whole thing is contrived. Now, that is not to say that there aren't serious economic problems that don't need to be addressed. There are. That's not to say that we're behaving in an economically healthy way. We're not. So we need enormous change. But it's important when you make a change, it's important if you're going to operate on a patient that you have a proper diagnosis. So I want to make sure everybody understands the extent to which the entire fiscal cliff description is totally contrived. And let me just walk through a couple things. I'm going to use you as the guinea pig, Franklin, to see if I can communicate that. First of all, we have not had audited financial statements as required by law for over a decade. The law was instituted in 1995. The federal government was supposed to produce audited financial statements. It never has, and it has regularly announced that it can't. And in the years, you know, in the over 17 years now that it can't, we have had over $4 trillion that I know of, just from my own documentation using federal documents. It's all up on the web. We've had over $4 trillion simply go missing unaccounted for. Now, if you have an institution that has refused to obey the laws of producing audited financial statements and complying with numerous laws related to its finances, and it has refused to comply with a law that says Congress, money cannot be spent unless appropriated by Congress, if $4 trillion is missing, we are spending way more than Congress is appropriating. So this is an organization which is in complete defiance of the law in the extreme, which means their financial statements and budget are totally meaningless. If you were a bank and you had a private corporation who was your customer who refused to produce audited financial statements as required by law and refused to comply with the laws related to financial management of their money, would you believe a word that they said?
No, but I'm not much of a guinea pig here because I didn't start out believing them. So.
Okay, so we're looking at a set of financial statements that have been produced by somebody who has refused to comply with the law for decades. So this is, you know, I won't say the word on the Saleri report, but I used to have a partner who would pick up a financial statement from somebody who we knew was untrustworthy, a group of, you know, we knew the board and the management was untrustworthy. He used to call it mouth, S-H-I-T, on paper. You know, so he'd look at the financials and he'd say, this is mouth on paper. Well, this is mouth on paper. So that's number one. We're not, you know, the numbers we're being given and the documents we're being given have no integrity. So that's number one. The second thing is trillions of dollars are missing. We know that revenues came in and liabilities, you know, securities went out and the books don't balance and trillions is missing and no effort has been made to figure out where that money went or to get it back. And the congressional auditor who is in charge of making sure that our expenses are in compliance with the Constitution of the United States during that period was none other than David Walker, who did absolutely nothing and said absolutely nothing, and Kelly Amira, who wrote a fantastic series for the Washington, for Insight Magazine, the Washington Times Magazine that went to all of Congress, asked David, tried to pin Walker down to why he was doing nothing, to trillions of dollars walking out the door, And he was clearly too afraid. I mean, he was playing the system. And so Kelly O'Meara said to him, will you publish a contract budget of all the defense contractors who run the accounting and information systems for the agencies that are missing $4 trillion? And he wouldn't do that. He promised he would do it the next year, and he never did. So this is a man who sat there and did absolutely nothing and let trillions of dollars float out the back door, said nothing and did nothing. You have unbelievable internal control violations, Franklin, because you have agencies where the biggest receiver of checks from the agency is also the company that has a contract to do their information and payment systems.
Mm.
They're paying the money to themselves. That is a violation of every internal control law in the book. And you have agencies where in huge areas with all the money, there's no government officials who understand or are in control of what's going on. It's being run by private corporations. So you know, David Walker is the last person in the world you want proposing solutions. David Walker facilitated the problem in the first place. Finally, the other, you know, another point is the federal budget. We know that for many decades we've had something called the black budget. And
yeah.
This is in the spirit of money going missing, or the mortgage fraud. The federal government engineered the housing bubble with federal credit, and you know, and that's part of the trillions that have probably gone missing. So we know the federal government has been engaging in things like the black budget for many, many years. And when you know, I always liken it to a milk bucket that has a hole in the bottom. When the farmer comes to you and says, "Oh, we need more milk. There's no milk in the milk bucket." Well, why is there a hole in the bottom, and where is the milk going to every time it flows out the hole in the bottom? So it requires a serious look in sort of the black budget. The last thing I wanted to say was, if you look at the federal budget on a place-based basis, it has a negative return on investment, and it has a negative return on investment as a matter of policy. You know, and I've written, talked a whole lot about that, but we have engineered the budget to control the economy as opposed to optimize the economy. And if you were to take the federal budget by county, I once showed you the federal agriculture subsidies coming into your county here in
yes.
in Tennessee, and you almost fell off your chair. If you look at the federal budget on a county level and you get the consolidated annual financial reports and look at where the money's going, two things are happening. It's being invested in a way that reflects a whole different series of political constituencies, but it also reflects a different kind of economy than the economy, you know, that technology and where we are now calls for. So it's an old model. It's an industrial economy that is no more. And it's engineered for political purposes instead of for a healthy economy. So, and if you were free to engineer it, there's plenty of money. So if you look at all these different issues of, and the last one I have to mention also is when you look at what's on budget and what's off budget, it's completely contrived. So let me give you an example. All the expense of going to war is on budget, but all the assets acquired in the wars are off budget. You are paying all sorts of corporate contractors to do all sorts of things. They create and invent tons of technology, but they own it privately. So we financed the space race and the space program, and now that we're ready to start mining, well, suddenly it's a private activity. And so, the federal credit is on budget, and when the banks get in trouble, the bailouts get done up to $27 trillion from the central bank and the government, but those benefits are off budget. So what is on budget and what is off budget is very carefully contrived to create a fiscal cliff where if you moved all the benefits and the assets on budget, it would be a totally different picture.
Right.
So the question is, when you come up with solutions that say, we're going to take all the assets and benefit and move them off balance sheet. So $27 trillion of the banks go over here to the right. And then we're going to put all the expenses on budget. And then we're going to say, okay, this group of American people suddenly has to pay for everything. And the fact that we've drained us of all sorts of trillions of dollars of missing money, well, we're not going to go get that money. We're not going to account for it. So you're basically shifting the liabilities to a group of people whose assets you're stealing at the same time. And so to me, the whole presentation is totally contrived. Am I making any sense?
The presentation of the fiscal cliff is contrived.
Right. Right. You have a very contrived presentation made to look like you have to cut Social Security and retirement benefits and Medicare and Medicaid dramatically.
Well, it actually is very clever, and it reminds me of what the Red Chinese used to do, you know, when they had the labor camps in the days when they were really killing people wholesale. The relatives never knew what had happened to their arrested relatives until they got a bill for the bullet that killed them. And so what you're telling me is that the government is one vast racket where not only they're shooting you, but they're sending you the bill and making you pay the bill for the bullet.
Right, and unfortunately, they're sending you the bill at the same time QE3 is going to raise the price of your oil and, you know, your oil and gas and your food and everything else.
Right.
So I think the wrap-ups next week, I'm going to talk a lot about how you jump the curve on the 1-2 punch, but I think it's very, very important for everyone to know that the 1-2 punch is coming. And what I do have to say is that every indication, Franklin, is that gold and silver for some foreseeable future can continue to play the role that they've played to date, which is protecting our assets from that 1-2 punch.
I don't see any indication, again, from a technical standpoint or from a standpoint of coming change that would indicate that's not so. I mean, as far as I can tell, they're going to keep on working. So.
Yep. Well, bear with me for a second, because before I'd like to turn to something a little bit more inspiring than the fiscal cliff, and that's our documentary for Let's Go to the Movies. But before I do, anything else you want to say on gold and silver or any wisdom you want to impart for the next 30 days before we're with you again?
No, I think I've pretty well covered it. I think you have to keep reminding yourself and asking yourself, if this is a primary trend, what do I need to do? And the answer is you need to hold tight.
Right. Well, I will say this. I was talking this afternoon with a group of people about the fiscal cliff and QE3 and what it would do to the average household budget. And I said, you know, contemplating all of this, I'm so glad that I'm going to spend the weekend with Franklin talking about how we transform and renew through this.
I was getting a little downcast myself.
Do you want to say anything about this weekend and what we're going to be up to?
I'm really beginning to look, I mean, I have been looking forward to it, but I'm really beginning to get excited about it because I've been reading the bios from the people who are coming, and it's just an incredible range of age and experience, and I want to hear what they have to say as much as I want to hear what I have to say.
It's a great group of people. It's many different states and Canada and America and many, many different places. And you're right, we range from, I think, 20 to 84.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wide range. Okay. Well, very quickly, we had a documentary called The School, Humanity's New Future. And I have to tell you, it's one of the most inspiring documentaries I've ever seen. It's on a school in Russia. That in which the children themselves designed, built, and decorated their own campus, and it's about the most beautiful school you've ever seen. And in fact, they also design their own curriculum, and they are they run the school, so they do the cooking, they do the cleaning, they do the administrative work. But they also design their own curriculum, and they are both students and teachers. So they can make up their mind, Franklin, for example, well, we want to learn physics this month, and we're just going to study physics until we feel we've mastered it, and when we are comfortable we've mastered it, then we'll pick something else. And so they really focus on different things, and you get people at, you know, children at very young ages who've mastered, you know, so 13-year-olds who've mastered quantum physics. And it's funny, the producer of the Solaria Report, Kristen Linton, said to me today, she's been a teacher, and she said, you know, these are not like any kids I've had. Did you get a chance to watch it yet, Franklin?
I read the article. I didn't get a chance to watch the.
Okay, well, it's there's sort of a crude version of it up on the web, and we put it in the blog post so you can watch it for free. You can also get a copy. It's not a long documentary at deepsnowpress.com. But I will tell you, it's one of the most inspiring things you've ever seen. So if the fiscal cliff is depressing you, pick up the school and take a look, because it's a wonderful example of what civilization can be, and it reminds you of the tremendous inspiration you get when you realize the enormous creative power that exists in each and every human being, and the potential we have as the human race, what we can be. So I recommend it very much, the school. Okay, well, Franklin, thank you so much for joining us. We will be back with you in November, and we will know I call them Monsanto and Goldman Sachs right and Monsanto Goldman Sachs left. So we will know which version of Monsanto Goldman Sachs will be in the White House next year. And so we will see what that has to do with the precious metals market.